This is Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from The Margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to determine what's significant to your future and why. How you doing, Paisan?
I'm doing good, brother.
Another great week to be with you. We have the great Georgette Pierre joining us, illustrious crew. We got to get to the brand F-up of the week. What we got, Phil?
Brand F-up comes from Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo, multinational bank. They do everything that you can imagine under the sun when it comes to finance. And they recently released an ad where they encouraged budding actors to become botanists, and then they've apologized. So basically, they had a series of print ads released nationwide with taglines like "A ballerina yesterday, an engineer today, an actor today, a botanist today, an actor yesterday, a botanist today." Mm-hmm. So basically, they're kind of shitting on the arts and humanities as valuable contributors to society.
Right.
And there was initial backlash at this, and then they released via Twitter an apology. And I want you guys to give your perspective on the ad and the apology itself. And what they went on to say in a statement via Twitter that Wells Fargo is deeply committed to the arts, and we offer our sincere apology for the initial ads. They were intended to celebrate the aspirations of all young people and fell short of that goal. We are making changes to the campaign's creative that better reflect our company's core value of embracing diversity and inclusion and our support of the arts. So there you go. What do you guys think?
What? Sorry. What? I dozed
You're
off.
Funny.
Georgette,
You're
go
funny.
Ahead.
So I'm going to be very honest with you all. I don't necessarily know if I felt... I'm over brands only apologizing when they get called out. If I saw the ads first, I don't necessarily know if I would have been as offended by it. I didn't take any offense to it.
You should
have
seen Matt's reaction to it. Well, he was livid.
When I read the article, I felt like her tone was very subjective, and so she was already like, fuck Wells Fargo. She didn't say that, but that's kind of where I felt like she was going with it. So it was almost a slight influence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because if you didn't feel that way, it was easy for you to feel that way by the time you finished reading this. And so I'm not disagreeing on how that could have been misinterpreted, but I did not. I was just like, if he didn't use actor and he used something else, I don't necessarily know if people would have been that offended. That fucking offended. I just wanted to say that. It's the whiskey. Y'all gotta
Georgette
fucking
is all
whiskey.
Lit.
It's all the whiskey.
I gotta
fault.
Just say, Georgette Shit. Is literally lit from whiskey. Like, I feel like we gotta do an experiment where you just smell it.
What?
And
that
see
you
what
can
happens.
Smell how lit I am?
Yeah, you don't even know. Like, literally, you don't even take a sip. You'd be ready.
Oh my gosh.
I think, all right, there's a couple of things about this. I mean, one, the ad's just kind of dumb. I think I get the thinking behind it, the notion that, like, I could see some type of agency getting all excited and designing like a, you know, I could see the thought process like, we got to get back to basics. You
right.
know, like, banks and financial services have done all these ads that have tried to, you know, build on your emotions and connect with a larger purpose and cause, but it's really just about, you know, making money and sort of protecting your future, and it's a down to earth thing. And, you know, these ads are about, you know, getting your head out of the clouds and doing something practical. I mean, it's a very kind of puritanical sort of like old school impulse. The other thing is, I mean, that's the trend right now. The trend from everybody. I mean, Marco Rubio, when he was running for president, you know, made that was one of his biggest lines in a stump speech, was like, you know, philosophy majors, fucking assholes, you know, like, become a plumber. I mean, that sort of thing. And the bigger context for that is that when we invade, you know, when we sort of hollow out society in terms of our economy, what's open to people, the options people have, and what we value, that spills over into all aspects of culture, from defunding arts education to Wells Fargo, ironically, having an uncreative and poorly executed ad. Almost as if there could have been more humanities education making these ads more effective.
Well, I want to add one more point.
Yeah, you go for it.
So the other thing that came to mind when you were talking, Michael, was, okay, so it's Wells fucking Fargo. Who would take that and not to say like to not take them seriously, but to say that Wells Fargo is offending any community.
I had like a 5-hour meeting with Phil. He talked me out of getting an accounting certification saw that. So it was a big thing.
Their ads are as basic as they come, and so I feel like they got a little excited, maybe, you know. But I listen, I don't think no, seriously, yeah, right? They got a little excited, got a little ahead of themselves. Maybe it's a new creative ad agency that they worked with this time. But to say that Wells Fargo was going to be the influence on people feeling like they're downtrodden or distraught on deterring them from pursuing creative avenues, I wouldn't take Wells Fargo that seriously.
Yeah, I think my take on it is pretty basic, that this is in line with sort of the way in which we think about education nowadays, right, and the way in which we think about opportunities, that we've become so STEM focused, and it just feeds into this idea of, like, you know, what are the careers that are worth going after, what are the path that makes sense, and there's this very powerful branding tool around STEM and science-based educations, particularly when you have a proliferation of focus on startup culture, technology, mm-hmm. and all of those things. So from that perspective, I don't think Wells Fargo really needed to apologize. I think they had a branding initiative that was very much in line with the way in which we think about our opportunities.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's a very vocal community that pushed back against that is fine, but I think we don't really realize how much these forces are enacted upon us in terms of what's acceptable, what's not, what makes sense. I mean, many of these brands, when they're out there, they're reacting to what they see around them. And an ad like this focused, you know, just a little slight bit more of context, it is focused for teens. So this is a part of a celebration of a teen day that Wells Fargo was marketing. You know, when I read things like an actor yesterday, a botanist today, a ballerina yesterday, an engineer today, that's a, you know, those were great ideas and thoughts when you were young and foolish and reckless, but now that you're getting more serious about what your life is all about, you might want to go in these other directions. And that's a thought process and a thinking that has existed from 50, 60, 70 years ago to now.
I tell Matt every day, I'm like, dude, you're not a fireman.
Well, shout out to all the botanists that exist, because they should have used chemists. That may have, you know, been along the theme.
I mean, there's a famous line in, like, I love Mad Men, like the quintessential, like, TV show around, like, advertising and all that kind of stuff. And there's a scene where, you know, Don Draper's, like, new wife, she wants to be an actress. And her mother is, like, this sort of French-Canadian, really hardcore. And she's like, yo, you're set up in this really cool apartment. Your husband's rich and... yo, the world just doesn't need that many ballerinas. Like, get over yourself. So I think this thinking has existed for a long time.
I agree.
You know?
But we hear it all the time. Listen, my parents are from the islands, and when I tell them, hey, I'm going to be this, I can't tell you how many times my mom tried to get me a job at her hospital.
I know they're watching another relationship host.
Oh, Lord.
Why, you know, work at the hospital. But you can help people that way. You talk about the relationships in the ward.
But
you know,
listen,
I don't be on no TV to do that.
When my parents, you sound more Jamaican, Michael.
I apologize for not delineating between Trinidad and Jamaica.
But I get that people feel like brands should have more of a responsibility, but I heard it from my parents, and I just chose to ignore them. And now they're like, oh, look at Jajet, you know, showing my YouTube web series and stuff like that. I mean, you just push past it. Like I said, Wells Fargo isn't a brand that I would take seriously.
Sean with them but two dope echo, boys. We love them so much.
To echo what you're saying, it hasn't gone anywhere, and I think, I don't know, I just don't like the idea of brands feeling like they have to constantly apologize and being super reactive if they really didn't mean. Like, I think they were proud of their ads.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Why apologize for that?
Because you can wring an apology out of anybody, which is the lesson of today's world.
The botanist,
and that is the brand F-up of the week. Now we got to go to What's Up.
Now we want to jump to what's up, and that comes to us from Kanye West, Yeezy Season 4. Basically, Kanye announced via Twitter that he's asking for a casting call featuring multiracial women only.
Easy season approaching. To put it lightly,
this caused quite a bit of backlash and controversy as people rejected this call for multiracial women only. A ton of controversy around that, but fortunately for us, we were right there to see it all happen via one of our crew, Georgette Pierre, who was at the casting call.
I was. Okay, so because you always say this, Phil, and it's my, I like it. So I must admit, when I first saw the casting call posted on Kanye's Twitter, it gave me pause. It gave me pause. It did, because the moment
you should use that more.
It gave me pause because I literally, there was a quick moment of me that felt like I wasn't in the group of women that he was talking about. Like, I'm gonna be very honest about that, and I think that's a lot. That was part of the backlash, right? Because it's people were erring on the side of is Kanye asking for women that are light skinned, or you know, does multiracial mean women that are, you know, mixed, they look a certain way,
can
diluting
you tease that out for the audience, because I think for some people listening, like when they hear multicultural, they actually just mean, like, I think a lot of people actually, it still cues for some people just like, oh, that means that he wants everybody of every background to come,
right? Okay, so
now explain what yeah,
so on fashionista.com, but you could pretty much find it anywhere, there was a point that was made that said there was a woman that was actually protesting. She carried a sign and painted the words, "They want black features, not black girls." And then she also wrote, "This casting call for multiracial only, not multi-ethnic, which would still be fetishization, asserts that black can only be beautiful when mixed with another race. There is a history of wanting to dilute the blackness of one's children because of the longstanding stigmatization of blackness." And so they were basically, I mean, people were in essence accusing Kanye of saying like, oh, you don't really want, you know, black women, like you want women that are mixed, like maybe they're light skinned, maybe their hair looks a different certain way,
biracial,
right? Like black and white, it doesn't, right? But you know, black women come in with all, we come in all shapes, sizes, ethnicities, beauties, and so I mean,
it's a great point. It's true.
I hesitated on wanting to go, and then this girl I used to work with, shout out to her, Aisha. She was posting about it on Twitter. And I was like, yo, let's go. Like, I want to go really bad. She said, I thought about going. I was like, let's do this. And so we started talking offline, and we literally set it up. She's been to casting calls for modeling before. And I was like, what are we going to do? What's our game plan? And the casting said from 11 to 5. I said, let's get out there at 10. It was at Jack Studios in Chelsea on 26th and 11th. I got out there at 10 o'clock, and there was already a line. The line wasn't crazy long, but let's just say it took us 3 hours to get in, just to spend less than 2 minutes getting our pictures taken.
Right.
And so we're in the line.
You're a trooper.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, listen, I'm not a model. I'm a host. I'm a producer. I'm quirky. I'm not quirky, but I talk my shit, you know. I don't wear makeup anyways, because that's what they wanted. And so when we were in line, you heard, like, you saw different women, like, they came with the idea of what they thought was going to get them selected and chosen, right? Whether it was their hair was a different color, whether it was what items they were wearing. I mean, if their titties were out, you know, cleavage. I mean,
don't
you,
say the car is topless.
So you came out here trying to get chosen, essentially, and whatever that idea was for you. And I mean, but there was also the camaraderie. There was women that were bigging each other up. There was a woman, shout out to Samira Flowers, who wrote a note that says, "You are great. You are beautiful. You got this. You are you." I'm paraphrasing. And she literally had people passing it back. And we didn't know who it was. You know, it was just kind of great. And it felt really good to see that. So by the time I got in the line, I was nervous. But the whole multiracial thing went out of my head. I was like, fuck it. I'm going.
Yeah,
and I could say that I did this, and I'm going to put down that I'm West Indian or from Trinidad and Tobago and American. And when you got in there, you literally saw a two photographer setup, and you literally took your picture facing forward and a side view, and then you were done.
That's
it. That was it. And so at least when I got there, they were doing a mix of people that had agencies – or were represented by agencies and people that weren't. And I think a bulk of the women that got there before a certain time, like myself, we were in the clear on getting in. In the Fashionista post, there was a picture that says that after a certain point, like around 4:40 p.m., they were only taking agencies, people that were rep by agencies. So, I mean, again, like, listen, there's going to be a lot of mixed views, but there was other women that I talked to when I was at work today, and they were like, oh, I just thought that meant, you know, you just had multiple ethnicities. A lot of people just...
Well, has Kanye come out and clarified that at all, or no?
No, he has not. I doubt he's going to.
Yeah.
But I think he was somewhere in the building when the casting call was happening. We just didn't see him. I felt like it was an accomplishment, because not on the sense of like, oh, it's Kanye, but it was, I did something that I was afraid to do. I literally am not a model. And when you're around people that are skinny or they look a certain way and they're beautiful, or you think they might be a lot more beautiful than you based off the beauty standards when it comes to modeling, you know, it was all those things. And I was like, no, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to big up the women that are in that line. And you know, like, the whole thing for us was we did it. And I let go of it. And so the back and forth I had with one of my girlfriends the other night over the weekend, I was like, I said, listen, I don't think Kanye meant to be exclusionary with mm-hmm. multiracial women only. She was like, I get that, but it's Kanye, and he knows better. He could have used any other word.
I think
although I did have slight pause in the beginning, after I went and did it, I kind of let go of it, because I saw women darker than me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was just like, no. Like, I was like, Kanye's fashion show for Yeezy Season 3 in February, there was a mix of,
yeah.
you know, color.
Well, that's the other plausible reading of it.
Right.
I mean, when you hear, I mean, this is what I think is in some ways, like, interesting. All of these conversations are, you know, they are like texts, and they're going to be heard and processed in different ways. But I know... for, you know, a lot of white people, to be blunt about it, they're definitely not going to be thinking about any of these distinctions.
Right.
Sort of like, you know, dynamics of like, what is that cue? So I think that that's, you know, that's relevant there. I guess I don't get the impression from Kanye's work that he's looking for like a specific look, and that that's a code word
for something
to exclude a certain type of representation. That's not the way I read what he's put out.
Right.
But I still, I mean, I, in some ways, like, the whole activity in and of itself is like crazy.
What do you mean?
Well, just like the notion that you have like a bunch of like, you know, chicks waiting in line for
like
a 1 minute photo. Like, I mean, that's normal, but I'm just saying that's part of like the absurd of like, you know, of just our kind of collective life. But I think, I mean, Phil, do you get the read that he was trying to send that like subtle cue or no?
I mean, my first reaction is that there's probably,
we'll see what happens when it's actually produced.
Yeah, but I
when George Jett's up there.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of like, there's both a very personal issue at stake with someone like Kanye, because he's married to someone who's not black.
Correct.
And having a daughter, but I think that's the personal piece of it, that like, you know, is he looking for a casting representation that maybe represents what he sees
right
in his family, right, as it's now developing and growing, because he now has a daughter and a son, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, now he has a daughter and a son that are by definition multiracial,
right?
But then there's now a bigger public piece to this, like the outward facing piece, that there are race and skin color dynamics within larger society, but those things are clearly emphasized within a black and white framework. So to when you do a casting call for multiracial, despite the fact that he may or may not be making sort of a personal decision, he is smart enough to know the racial dynamics of what he's talking about and what the response is going to be once you put that casting call out. I mean, Kanye, whether you dissect him as a personal figure or you dissect his lyrics for numerous songs, he understands the dynamics of black, white, racialized relationships around sex and relationships.
I mean, I definitely think the term multiracial was intentional. I think Kanye does have a specific look, though, right? Yeah. Like, Kanye knows what he wants, and he's not afraid to say that. Now, I guess
that may vary, though. You know, I think that's, like, a better way of what I was trying to say earlier. But it's not that he doesn't have very specific things that he wants in mind,
right?
But it's not always the same thing. Now,
so what would there have been backlash if he said white women only, black women only,
yes.
Asian women only?
Yes.
So that's what I'm saying. Yes. Like, there's no way to cut this up.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think had he asked for black women only, there would have been no backlash.
I don't know if, like, I agree with
that. Nah, he'd have been all good if he said that. You can, if it's when you, because the politics of that, they're like, there's politics in all of this.
Right.
And the reality is that we know who gets the magazine covers.
Covered,
we
right.
know who gets who the majority of runway in the fashion world. That's not a secret. So if you cast opposite that,
right,
there's not going to be no problem with
what
that.
Is it,
because now it's like, okay, you bringing people in. But a week earlier, there was that study that came out about face mapping research that cited that Amber Heard, by this criteria, has the most beautiful face in the world. And just to read a little bit of about
absolutely
this,
correct.
Let me see
basic.
What she looks like.
She has an extraordinary white face.
And so the research was led by Dr. Julian Da Silva. And it goes on to say that Dr. Da Silva and his team used computer mapping and research that incorporated the ancient Greek beauty ratio phi to determine what made a face beautiful.
People are out of their
the ratio
mind.
Uses measurements of 12 key markers to determine one's beauty, including the lips, nose, eyes, eyebrows, chin, forehead, and facial shape.
Nerds can't be involved in this study.
Yeah. And this
is the problem.
This came out in the summer, but it actually got attention literally just last week. I saw this picked up by, like, BET.com and other articles, basically pushing back on this because most of the women cited in this study were all, like, non women of color.
You know,
they weren't all white because they didn't include Kim Kardashian, and she's not strictly by definition European white.
She, like, Armenian.
She's Armenian,
yes,
right?
And that ain't white.
But no. I get it. But she falls into the. I think when I think about.
Eventually white in America.
Right,
by global standards, she falls into the political standards of whiteness, but she ain't really white.
You know? She falls into the privileges.
I mean, I think the thing that I just want to note on this conversation, that what in some ways is the most fascinating to me about this, is the idea that in the world we're in today, that, you know, we talk about Shout Out from the Margins, obviously. That's in the intro to the show. And now it's like, you know, the conversation has in some ways, and this is a good thing, obviously, that it's gotten more sophisticated, because we're not just talking about, you know, representation. We're talking about what kinds of representation, how, where, when, and why. And it's fascinating to me that, like, social media empowers the particulars of this debate way beyond, you know, just even the sort of, like, traditional conversations we've had, just in terms of, like, it's not just who is there, it's what type of who is there and how is it being selected and how does it fit into, again, even like the study that Phil just cited. So whether or not it's Kanye's intention or not, regardless, the way it was sort of capitalized by a certain group of women and activists to highlight this entirely different conversation that, I could tell you, like, in whitey world is not, like, a prime topic of conversation.
Right.
Right? Like, there's a conversation where it's like,
yeah, I
don't,
I think
Vanessa Williams. Yeah, no.
That's the positive thing,
regardless of how it kind of emerges.
In a broader culture, does it have to happen?
Right, and exactly.
So, like, if I'm looking at, like, for example, this let's just say, because I don't know if you've made this clear, and I don't want to add validity to just the fact, just because something is a study doesn't mean it's valid, and clearly this study is garbage. So I want to make that unequivocal, that
the Greek standards.
Yeah, this study is garbage, and it uses all the usual tropes, like, oh, Greek standard and all this
right.
all this nonsense to make us feel like it's valid. But if I look at this list of their 10 most beautiful women, It's Amber Heard, Kim Kardashian, Kate Moss, Emily Radzowski, Kendall Jenner, Helen Mirren, Scarlett Johansson, Selena Gomez, Marilyn Monroe, and Jennifer Lawrence.
That's Trina.
Clearly, that clearly reinforces no ideas that we know exist as being culturally biased.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we can't pretend that Kanye is not influenced by this.
Correct.
And so when he makes a statement asking for multiracial women, that plays into this long-standing history that we can't fail to recognize is out there.
I feel like after it's said and done, because Kanye's really kind of, you know, balls to the wall, focused, because his show is, I think, happening tomorrow night, and he's still doing his concerts, because he has his concert tonight. I think maybe after everything's said and done, I think he might make some Kanye comments on Twitter.
And that's what's up.
I think, right, exactly.
Now we got to get to what's next. So now we got to get to what's next. And this is something that has sort of emerged recently, but it's going to open us into a much wider discussion, something for the future, something that's going to take us into the past and the present. So Charlie Hebdo, who everybody, I think, is sort of familiar with, it was the site of a terrorist attack a couple years ago in France. It's a French satirical newspaper and periodical. It's very controversial, and a couple of years ago, several of its staff were murdered in a terrorist attack in Paris. Now, the fallout of that debate about Charlie Hebdo has been really fascinating, because people have sort of emerged on different sides of this conversation. Obviously, no one has sort of justified, obviously, the murder of these journalists or the terrorist attack, but there has been a sort of divergence in terms of, is Charlie Hebdo this sort of important satiric voice that in almost in a certain way can be kind of fetishized and valorized and is really important in and of itself? Or is it, you know, more the equivalent of, you know, we wouldn't support, obviously, you know, Al-Qaeda running up on Fox News in the United States, and we don't want anybody to be harmed, and we are obviously opposed to terrorism adamantly, but we wouldn't turn around and say if somebody got harmed, you know, all of a sudden that would validate their work. We might say that they still did garbage work. So anyways, that's sort of the basic contours of the debate around Charlie Hebdo. This past recently in August, there was a really tragic earthquake in Italy. Many people died, and Charlie Hebdo released a cartoon with sort of, you know, very, you know, kind of to the extent that they're even visible as Italians, because they're kind of bloodied and mashed up. We'll have then a link to this on our on the show description page. And it says, and these are different Italians that were in the earthquake. So one is a bed of corpses underneath rubble. It says lasagnas. Another one says penne gratinis, and basically, you like, you can get the joke. It's different types of pasta and people mashed up from the earthquake. And then the cartoon also asked, did the earthquake scream Allahu Akbar before shaking? There was a huge outcry on social media in terms of just sort of responding to this in Italy. Valentina Castaldini, a national spokesperson for the center-right, for the new center-right party, basically said that it was, you know, a slap in the face to loved ones and, you know, people grieving, people killed. So this opens a conversation up about free speech, decency, and sort of how we're going to kind of govern everything from, you know, decency to dealing with a multicultural, multiracial, multipolar world. There might be some disagreements in this panel, but let's open it up. Whichever one of you guys wants to jump in first.
Go ahead, Phil.
That was a really intense right there. That was like the simultaneous.
Yeah. Mouth open.
I
but,
know.
No words.
Right.
I mean, Charlie Hebdo to me is completely like, they're just bullies. You know, like, I don't believe in this idea that you can say whatever you want to say and then hide behind like free speech and satire. And it doesn't take this particular set of cartoons to sort of to set me off in any way. So yeah, the Italian cartoons, and those who go on the show notes will be able to check them out. Of course, they're incredibly insensitive and just also not funny. But they've made a history of this. Well,
these people are French. I mean,
yeah, so
notoriously unfunny people.
Yeah, and it shows. You know,
they like Jerry Lewis, for Christ's sake.
They use the power of the pen and the power of their branding to punch down and just say and do things that are, to me, without any sort of value, whether that's entertainment value or satirical value. And the cartoons they made when the drowned Syrian toddler, Aylin Kurdi, you know, they made one cartoon when he died, and then they made another cartoon like, oh, had he grown up, he would have been like a groper, sort of like sex offender type of character. Like, I'm like, who's that funny to? And the people who that is funny to, I don't really want to know who those people are, like, in my life, you know. And I think those of us who are moving toward being more, you know, conscientious and just more aware of other people's feelings, we talk about our cultural prime directive all the time. And one of the standards of that is to have a love-based revolution. You know, nothing about Charlie Hebdo is a love-based revolution. It's just an attempt to hurt, harm, and add nothing to the discussion. So, you know, I'm pretty resolute in that position because I don't see the value in anything that they do.
It's funny that you said that, because the first question I had in my notes about this article was, what do people like about the satirical newspaper? And the reason why I asked that was they were, from last year, being targeted with the whole hashtag, it was J'suis Charlie, right? Mm-hmm. In support. And then all of a sudden, here's another story, and then everyone's like, you know, they're losing interest in Charlie Hebdo. I'm like, but why is it taking something that you feel, they haven't been doing anything differently. People were killed and targeted, and they're still carrying the same tone. And I don't know why people are surprised. That's kind of where I think I'm a little baffled. What are you surprised by? What are you surprised by? They are making fun of people that died. And I don't, you know, and I think a lot of times we wait until it affects us personally, or we're personally offended by something. But we also, and I'm just generally speaking, but I think the people also give Charlie Hebdo power, empower them, because you all are still supporting this. What is it going to take for them to fall back and allow this, you know, satirical newspaper to not to say learn their lesson, but
I mean, look, this is a problem. I always wish that in so many of these conversations there was like a kind of third position that you could stake out. But like, I have to push back on some of this just in some very basic ways.
And
like,
what, them or?
No, just, I mean, look, even having a conversation about Charlie Hebdo, even if we table, and there's an interesting conversation we can get into about like the French satiric tradition. Let me just stipulate right out the gate. I don't think anybody at this table thinks that they're funny. I think even if that type of humor is working under its own terms, it's not really a type of humor that, particularly in cartoon form, I'm interested in.
Right.
So, whatever. You can just kind of table that in a certain sense. But, like, I have to say, like, the notion of framing them as bullies a couple years ago, after a couple of people straight up came in and, like, gunned down people in their offices, is an alarming frame to me. Like, and they also come from this tradition. They were started in the 60s. It's this very vulgar, specifically French satiric traditions of like an innate good and innate purpose in taking on quote unquote sacred cows. So the truth is, if you go through their portfolio, they have gross shit about the Pope. They have gross shit about, you know, anything that could conceivably offend anybody. Now, there's no doubt that they have, and even just like this Italian earthquake, they put in the Allahu Akbar joke, which actually I have to say objectively is by far the most clever thing I've ever seen come out of, like, that's the only thing I've seen where I'm like, oh, I can kind of see that joke. Most of the shit I've seen is just not funny. But they have no, like, but even, but I'm saying besides that joke, that's what they're doing. They went and they took this horrible event and they tried to make something provocative out of it. I mean, it's kind of like the way people would perceive like shock jocks here, some of whom are funny, you know, like Howard Stern, certainly in his prime, could be very funny. Others of them are just fucking, you know, gross knockoffs. But all of whom could have been at times absolutely racist, misogynist, wrong, and problematic. And I just think there's three tracks of like, we don't have to valorize them and not critique them, because that's the other extreme. That's like, I'm not just Sweet Charlie because I don't like their shit. Yeah. But I also do think, whoa, fundamentally, nah, that's a real fucking issue to have, you know, Al-Qaeda dudes come in with assault rifles and murder some people because they didn't like a cartoon. That's real shit.
Well,
and
it can't just be
tabled at
things. Yeah, no, but it has to be.
When the conversation gets flipped to they are just cultural bullies, like, no, they're actually a newspaper which, regardless of any of us personal opinions about them, they have decided, even after people getting fucking gunned down, that they're going to keep putting this shit out.
But when
now, maybe they're just morons, but I mean, there's some fucking sticks to that, and clearly a belief that what they are doing is important for the preservation of some type of public expression of satire.
Yeah, but
and that's an important part of the argument.
I think like that conflates two separate things. Like, one, Charlie Hebdo has every right under, you know, the French rules of, I'm assuming, journalism and freedom of speech to publish whatever they want. An attack on them that's a physical base attack that leads to people getting murdered and gunned down is completely out of bounds, and no one's saying that it should be a tit for tat.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
I know that,
but
saying that,
I also don't think that the fact that they've continued on this road, like, is any sort of like validates their high stake game. I think that we should evolve enough to look back on any tradition and say, like, yo, does this still make sense? Does it make sense for you to attack things? Because, yeah, you can say, yeah, they attack sacred cows and what have you, but I think we can all agree, or we should all realize, that not all sacred cows are the same, you know? So attacking and making comments about the Pope and the Catholic Church, that ain't the same as like having pictures of drowned Syrian refugees and people in an earthquake. Like, that's not even on the same level, because at the end of the day, the church doesn't care.
No, but, well, no, that's,
because the
that's
church is
not
super,
true. Well,
the
no,
church
that's
is super
true.
Powerful, dude.
The church definitely cares.
They don't
the
give a shit.
No, they certainly care.
They might care from a public perspective, but the Catholic Church is out there making tons of money.
They're
one of the most
losing
powerful
a lot of people and influence in Europe right now. They're losing record numbers of people being involved in the church. But I mean, I take your point that they have more like social position at the time, but they certainly care. But I mean, as an example, like, there was one that they put out a couple years ago, and I'll read this from the New Republic. Almost entirely missing in the debate about Charlie Hebdo is any discussion of how intent and aesthetics might be at odds. Consider the notorious Charlie Hebdo cover showing a pregnant Nigerian woman captured by Boko Haram screaming, "Don't touch our benefits." At a superficial glance, the cover might seem like a lurid display suggesting that African immigrants in France are welfare queens. A detailed exegesis from a blog understanding Charlie Hebdo tries to refute the initial impression by noting that the real targets of the cartoon are wealthy French people who are the ones complaining about the loss of benefits for large families. In essence, the cartoon is taking aim at these French whiners who have first world problems compared to those kidnapped and attacked by Boko Haram. That's in a Jeetier piece called Arrested Development, The Aesthetic Failure of Charlie Hebdo. So again, it's not a justification, but there's obviously like more going on there than just that they're, you know, doing an Opie and Anthony. And they've been killed over it, which again, I have to say, I can't just table that as quickly. Like, when you get elevated to that issue where you're connected with a broader conversation about murdered for what you put out, then there's automatically more stakes to it.
My only thing is with this.
Yeah.
Not to say that they should silence their voice, but when do you know your boundaries? When do you find boundaries? I just think sometimes it just sounds like they crossed the line, and you would have thought people getting killed would have been a wake up call, and them being a target would have been a wake up call. But the fact that they still don't give a shit.
Well, maybe their response to being murdered and targeted is we need to double down on defending what we do.
Especially the revenue after they
go. Well, I don't understand. Like, again, like, I feel like if you're that's a really problematic response, taking aside the specifics of what they do. But if the response is like, we were targeted by a terrorist organization, that's not going to bode well for the future of anything. Are you crazy? That is such a fucked up premise. Like, you cannot possibly be serious. If we put something out on this show and we got targeted by a fucking white right-wing militia, like, just expand it a little bit, and they shot one of us, and the response was, well, better not do those multicultural conversations anymore.
No, that's ridiculous.
What are you talking about?
There's
some boundaries.
The principle
is absolutely the same.
I don't think it is.
If you are not guarding that speech, then it's not guarded.
No one is saying that they can't say what they want to say, but I can critique
you can critique it, that's fine.
If the people who are at the forefront and core of your messaging are looking at that and being like, yo, I'm not really with what you're saying, then I don't think
Al-Qaeda was at the core
of their messaging, but regular French people who have been colonized by the French, who live in the French in ghettos, and we just saw like 2 weeks ago a person being forced to take off a burkini on a beach. Like, yeah, let's not pretend that like the French don't have this sort of mentality. They want to be like, oh, we liberty, we free, without any understanding or place in their part in colonizing these people.
They're still that's you just told me I took it a field.
I'm saying that like you can't say that like, yo, they're just out here like promoting this particular free speech without pretending that there's not a political and social agenda that's attached to that the rank and file ain't getting.
Yeah, all so that shit cool is simultaneous. Like what that person all in New that Republic, shit is simultaneous.
The person in New Republic can break down all of that, but the average person who's picking up this paper ain't seeing all that analytical shit. They're seeing like, yo, immigrants are coming in here. They ain't French. Even if they had a recent New York Times article about the situation in Calais where all these people are in what they call the jungle, ghettoized by French society. And I think like Charlie Hebdo on a very base level, they speak to that and they make that okay. And that's not cool.
But we're getting into, look, if you want to have a critique of them and their cartoons and their argument and the role they play in the broader patterns they fit into, I would tend to agree with that probably 100%. But we cannot bypass so easily the reality that when you get into another, and look, I don't care per se about hypocrisy. Like, yes, the reality is that simultaneously France is a deeply racist, colonizing, imperialist country that has right to this day, not even just in terms of like racism, Charlie Hebdo, it has surveillance policies and massive violations of these communities right now, okay? And it does have a tradition to some degree that you do need to preserve domestically of open culture, which includes also, frankly, that Muslim comedian, I believe of Moroccan heritage, who got fined for Holocaust denial. Like, mm-hmm. I don't agree with that either. And that dude's also definitely a fucking asshole. So you can't, and I just think when you bring in the stakes, like that, when you set up the conversation of these people got fucking murdered, that's not just like a gloss before going back to chastising them for having bad taste. That is a major issue for how this shit is governed in today's world. Like, that is fundamental. Because when you start opening up a situation where it's like really the upshot of five of your people being murdered in your offices is that you have bad taste, we are headed in a really problematic direction. French people aren't funny.
That's what's next. That's, yeah. Let's get to the crate.
Yes. I can agree with that.
All right, let's get to the crates. And I would like to get to my crates, which is every past issue of Charlie Hebdo. Hilarious magazine.
You're so silly. A fool, yo. Such a fool.
Gotcha, y'all. Phil, what you got, man?
Oh, mine is actually a book. It's called The Shape of Design by Frank Camiro. And I forgot how I came across Frank Camiro's work. It might have been from Brain Picker a few years ago. I'm not 100% sure how he kind of fell into my zeitgeist, but I really loved the book and, you know, downloaded it and got it bound from Kinko's or Staples.
Oh, I thought it came like that because looking through it.
No, it didn't come like that. I took the PDF and printed it out and then actually got it printed up or bound at Staples, which I recommend for those who are frustrated reading PDFs, which I am. And it's just a great book about the very philosophical concepts around design and how design impacts our life. I think it's part poetry, part prose. It's very like beautifully drawn and thought out. I think it's a nice simple book that can kind of attract anyone, even if you're not like a super design addict, into that world, and you can apply the lessons from design into almost anything, which is what I use it for. And again, it's called The Shape of Design by Frank Camiro.
Georgie. It's me.
Georgette.
Gigi. Okay, so this is a triple threat.
That would be your Jewish name.
Would it?
Yeah.
No.
I just decided.
Yeah, a triple threat, and this is sponsored by the whiskey. I'm just kidding. It's only because I had two songs.
I just want to be clear to everybody. She literally has had like four sips.
Yeah,
of whiskey
like fucks this me up. Like I'm really I don't do whiskey.
Cheap date, fellas.
But if you all ever want to send me anything, sparkling wine, prosecco, champagne, just so you know, Fiji water. It's a book and two songs. The first book is The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. I actually am rereading the book, and it's really more so just stressing the idea of living in the present moment. A lot of times we get anxiety, and it mentioned that anxiety is created by us either living in the past or living in the future, and us not being satisfied with what we have going on in our present moment now. And so it's just telling us to focus on it. The two songs that I have was inspired by Labor Day weekend because of Caribbean Massive Ting. And a new fucking album that dropped. And Matt's a super producer, so he'll remix these joints for you so he can preview it. I get excited when he drops the songs. I do.
Me too. We all
Birds in the Trap Sing McKnight, Travis Scott's new album. That's the title of the fucking album is actually hilarious to me. But my track is the track that I like the most. And Andre 3000's on there for those that like Andre 3000. He is on there. But the track that I like is called Way Back. I can't give no rest. Okay, and then the second, I fall asleep with a tech. The beat is banging. Travis Scott is known for just trap beats that thump bass. That beat goes so fucking hard. And then the last song is Frighty and Colonel Might. It's called Life, but Ragamuffin, Ragamuffin. Y'all know that song. Life is what you make it.
Of course.
My dear. Yeah, so I heard it at a Caribbean cookout I went to this weekend, and I like was lit up, knees up in the air, all of that. So those are my crates.
Damn. Top that. I can't wait to hear this.
I do not plan to top that. Going in a completely different direction.
We already know what tone you go with all your fucking crates.
Tell me,
Michael.
Well, tell me what tone I go.
Oh,
with
so
all
this
my...
this book that I read was
drug cartels.
Drug cartels.
Oh, I'll give you a movie.
Politics, also a good film. This cartel killed 10,000 people.
It's worth watching.
Teach you about.
Oh my God,
both
I love
the
it.
International economy and the black market.
And watch it be that too, Phil, right?
Now you're going to switch it up.
I know, yeah.
Basically, now I'm going to switch
frantic
it up.
Frantic Google search.
Yeah, frantic.
I'm going to give you one where I'm going to play the type. I'm going to give you Europe's left after Brexit. Which is an article in the Jacobin by Greece's former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. But like, low key, this stuff is actually really interesting. And this is all about like remaking a global political project in a way that might make our world a much, much better place. And like, you know, we were talking about Europe earlier with Charlie Hebdo, and basically like, this block of the world, which has been, I think, just like conceived in our imaginations as like stable in a certain way, is not. And like, but this notion of moving the European project to like a continental democracy versus technocracy is actually potentially really inspiring, could have a big impact on people's lives. From 2006, you know, actually you 2016, excuse me, with 2016 Carnival, you inspired me, Georgette. And Matt, I also want cut in. Yeah. Michelle Montano.
Oh.
Need it.
Anything by him.
Dope song.
Michelle Montano. Everybody,
we talked about Michelle Montano in one of our first episodes. People need to be on this dude.
Oh, yeah. I need to.
Need it. Yeah. Michelle Montano. Oh, you didn't even know about it?
Yeah. I mean, but you know.
Fuck out of here.
No, you know
I hit
funny?
You from the intellect, and I hit you from Michelle. No response to that.
No.
Thank you, Georgette, for being on this week's Two Dope Boys in a Podcast.
You're more than welcome, fellas. I love being here with you all. Bring me on more fucking often.
You will be brought on more fucking
Yeah, I would
often.
Love to see
That's
you.
That's how you get
can't
on.
Top that.
Yeah. Phil, thank
Dude,
you.
Pleasure.
Pleasure as always. Super producer Matt Leck. See you all on Thursday.
Peace.
Peace.